This week on Barbell Shrug, we interview Erin Cafaro, Olympic gold medalist in rowing, and her lover, Brian McKenzie.
Hey, this is Rich Froning. You're listening to Barbell Shrug. For the video version, go to barbellshrug.com.
Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Bledsoe here with Doug Larson. We left Chris Moore at home, and we traveled to Cookeville, Tennessee. Sorry, Chris. He'll be on the next show, hopefully. We traveled to Cookeville, Tennessee to hang out with Brian McKenzie and Erin Cafaro. Damn, I asked you right before the show, too.
You gotta be Erin, a good Italian.
Erin Cafaro.
Cafaro.
Yeah. I practiced it and everything.
I know.
We had a discussion, right. Threw me off. We're here because you guys are running an athlete cell camp at CrossFit Mayhem, and you're going to be coaching. You're coaching Rich Froning a little bit this week.
Yeah. I've been working with Rich for kind of little bit on and off for the last couple of years, and then a lot this year within the endurance stuff.
So he'll be getting in the pool tomorrow.
Yeah, we're getting in the pool tomorrow.
Maybe CTP will be able to catch some of that footage.
I'm sure he will.
Is that one of Rich's Achilles heels right now? His swimming isn't quite up to par with his weightlifting and his gymnastics?
I think if you watched the CrossFit Games last year, you will have noticed a 30th plus place in the swim event. Right. He doesn't like that 30th marker. No.
Yeah, now you have to crawl your way back from behind.
Dig yourself out of a hole.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely is Achilles heel for him. I don't think so much anymore. He's been doing some work with a coach out here who's she was a D1 swimmer. And he's, between all the guys that have been out here, the feedback has been his technique has changed a ton, which is great because I'm throwing workouts out at him and right. I can only do so much from being in Southern California.
Right.
What's your background with swimming? I know when people think Brian McKenzie, I think running, even though you have a swimming and cycling in your book.
Yeah.
But do you have a big swimming background as well?
I actually have a bigger swimming background than I do of a running background.
Even if you're not on a board?
Yeah.
You're all about some surfing.
I'm all about the surfing. I'm actually more of a surfer than I am anything, but I swim 1 to 2 times a week when I'm typically at home. But I swam from about the age of 4 till probably 21 or 22. So almost 20 years. And you know, I got tired of the lane line thing, but I had an extensive background with swimming. So I mean, fairly extensive. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. And Erin, what's your background? You're probably the most decorated person here.
Yep.
Let's see. I started out playing basketball, cross country track in high school, and then walked on to the rowing team at Cal Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And that worked out pretty well for me. So I got invited, won 2 national championships while I was at Cal. And then that kind of boosted me onto the national team and won, I think it was about 6 world champion, no, 3 world championships, but every time I competed, I was on the podium. So that
anytime
helped.
You can't count your world championships, you're doing just fine.
Yeah.
There's how many did I get again?
Like at home, there's so many damn medals in the safe that it's just between the 2 golds from the Olympics and then world championship medals as well. The world championship medals are actually pretty badass looking. So
I hope so.
Can we get some pictures of those?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, the World Championships one, they look like a big, quarter.
Yeah, but they're really, really shiny.
Oh.
They look a lot, whatever.
We should like
other than the jade that's on the 08 gold medal, which is actually the more expensive medal.
Yeah, but the Sochi Olympics, did you hear that they had, part of meteorite was put in some of the medals?
No.
I know.
Wow.
Could have had some meteorite.
I should have.
If she was a winter.
I could handle the cold and had a pair, then yeah, I think I would have
I've heard of people switching over from whatever sport they were in to bobsled.
Bobsled.
This is super common.
Yeah.
A lot of track and field athletes.
Super fast.
Push.
Yeah.
Be really quick and jump in and hold on for dear life.
I'm trying to remember who I talked to last. I talked to someone last and they were like, and then I did some bobsledding. What? It's like they had this sports background and went bobsledding and now they're doing this other thing.
Yeah.
It's like, just crazy.
Yeah.
So what do you think made you so naturally good at rowing, or do you even feel like you're naturally good at rowing? We'll start there. You kind of just said, I walked on and then I won a world championship.
yes and no. I would never consider myself a naturally talented athlete by any means, especially in rowing. Like the typical rowing athlete is at least 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And for women, they weigh, you know, around 175.
So it's typical for women to be 6 feet tall.
Yeah. So I lived in the land of giants. That's why I like being around CrossFitters, because then I feel like I'm a big girl again. But just walked on to at Cal. And it's not that it was easy. Mm-hmm. It was that all the work that I put in, you could see it paid off. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like a one-to-one. Like the more work you put in, the harder you work, the better you got. And I really like that. Not so much, you know, in basketball, you could work your ass off and still suck. But, you know, it kind of just, I think it was right place, right time. Mm-hmm. And I happened to walk on to one of the best teams in the country. Mm-hmm. So that helped as well, and had one of the best coaches in the country.
Specifically
so,
for the rowing part of it?
For rowing, yeah.
How was the strength conditioning at the time? Did you go in with a big strength background or?
No.
So that was all new to you then?
Yeah. I was all, you know, I was just an endurance athlete. I guess that's the naturally talented part. I'm good at suffering. Like that's what I'm good at.
That goes
I don't
a long
know.
Way in CrossFit and rowing, you know, any sport where you're having to push like that lactic threshold.
Yeah.
Being able to suffer.
It's not necessarily the starting or getting out there fast, but once, you know, you get into suffer land, that's where I'm at home. So I like the endurance sports. And then was 2008 or the fall before 2008, you know, I'm undersized for a rower. And there's, you know, equation, power, force times distance. Couldn't make up for the distance. You know, I wasn't getting any taller. So tried to work on my force.
Yeah.
And my brother introduced me to Kelly Starrett over at San Francisco CrossFit. And they started giving me supplemental programming. And I got stronger and I got faster on the water. And that's how I got into, you know, the strength and conditioning world.
Mm-hmm. What did that strength program look like? Lots of squatting, box squatting?
No, it was actually, so, you know, we did a lot of volume. As Brian said, we did more volume than marathoners, or about the same amount of volume as marathoners. And as a rower. Yeah. It was like over 200K a week. And,
I do like 5K, my ass falls asleep on the concept too.
I think for reference, people should understand that their race is only 2 kilometers.
Exactly.
So it's like a 7-minute race for women.
Mm-hmm. Under 6 minutes. So yeah, typically. Wow. So it's, you know, a little counterintuitive, but still, you know, just worked on the strength and conditioning piece, and it obviously seemed to help.
So 200K a week, most people are more familiar with like a 500 meter row, which is half a K.
Yeah.
So you're doing the equivalent of 500 meter rows every single week back then.
Doug likes to think in math.
I know. I'm like, I think like, you lost me.
when she was training for the Olympics. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I was trying to break it down for CrossFitters so they can understand really what that means.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what a 500 meter row means in the CrossFit world, but 200K, they go, I don't know what that means.
500.
So do you have any tips? This is the most important part of the podcast. Do you have any tips from my ass not falling asleep on a concept to row? Because that's pretty common.
Yeah, no, that is common. I know actually a couple things. First thing that I just found out lately from my good position coach over here is, you know, sit more on your high hamstrings rather than down on your butt. It's going to help your back get in a better, straighter position and be able to use your posterior, not just your anterior. Everybody thinks that they're, you know, their quads are just blowing up on the rowing machine. But if you do it correctly, you should be able to use both systems, right? If you're tucked under, that's when things are going to turn off. The other thing is get a seat pad. If you don't know what that is, just look it up. I'll show you one. Yeah. All you have to do is
seat pad saves everything. And plus it gives you a little lift, so it changes the position of it's almost like wearing an ollie shoe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. I've run into rowers who would see my ollie shoes and go, "Oh, that looks a lot like a rowing shoe. Is that Is that accurate? Or was I talking to somebody? Oh, all right.
The rowing shoes are exactly like track shoes without the spikes.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're on footboards, just like the ones on the Concept 2. You can actually alter the pitch.
Uh-huh.
And then it also helps. You can actually alter how far in and out they go, which is very helpful. I be great to do that on the Concept 2 as well. Get a little bit wider.
Have you been
base.
On that newer Concept 2 that kind of it moves with you?
Oh, the dynamic one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, that helps you have, it's a little bit truer to the feel of the water. So on the Concept 2, there's on the original one, there's a little bit of this dead spot in the front. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but like when you're in compression.
Talking about the old one with the wood handle?
No, just the normal Concept 2, not the dynamic one.
Okay.
And it kind of jerks you back when you basically get the resistance. That's not how it feels on the water. There's no
slack on the water.
Exactly. There's no slack unless you, what we call miss water. And then, you know, the boat jolts. So the dynamic erg was created because it does have more of that. It encourages more acceleration. Like it doesn't have as much resistance in the front and encourages you to build the acceleration throughout. So that's why.
More like cool. being on the water.
Yeah.
Another difference with the way you guys row is you're rowing on one side.
Some of us, yeah. They call us sweep donkeys.
Sweep donkeys.
Go to one side. Scholars, they're more technical. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's a single, so that's, you know, person just balling out by themselves. And then there's a double and a quad, which is four people. They're definitely a little bit more technical. You have two oars to handle, not just one. And... then sweep is what I did, going off to one side and you walk around crooked.
Yeah, so you've developed like some massive asymmetries because of
this.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we actually just saw like Dr. Nate Maynard here in Cookeville, and he straightened you out.
Yep. It's getting better.
I didn't hear the screams coming in the room the room. Like it was when I was in there, I was screaming. You were nice and quiet. Maybe I'm just
remember that thing about suffering.
Yeah.
She likes songs.
So what all have you done over the years to help kind of alleviate some of those asymmetries just to keep yourself healthy?
CrossFit, I like to say. And also
broad
finding,
term.
Yeah. also, you know, not trying to favor, think about, you know, oh, I'm rowing off the right side, so I need to do more left side things. No, I need to actually be more conscious of that and do, you know, lift a barbell, but realize that I'm going to compensate, you know, have this compensation pattern.
Right.
So... you know, lift it, still use both sides, but
just
also,
yeah,
awareness.
Yeah. And the general thinking, even within the rowing world or any world of sports specificity is that's okay. You're just going to overdevelop that side so that we can get, you know, cross that line.
You might break a few ribs, you might herniate a few discs, but after that, you'll be good to go. Now you're initiated.
And literally that is what happens with all of them.
Yeah.
You know, and, you see changes that get, you know, if you actually, oh, well, what if we actually attack the other side? What if we help build this up? And it's like they get better, they get stronger, they don't break down, they don't, you know, it's just.
Yeah. I mean, that happens with almost any sport that's not a strength sport is you develop these, you know, left to right asymmetries. You know, baseball pitchers have, you know, their shoulders are, you know, one side's higher or lower than the other. And so I think it's like a good thing for people who have played a sport for a long time where they develop these asymmetries to have like, they need to be aware, where a lot of people probably don't think about what they're doing. They're just going in and training and not thinking, you know, I need to make sure that I'm not, you know, using, you know, my right side more, you know, if I'm right-handed, like maybe I'm using my right side too much or something like that. And making sure your left side engages.
Well, and also we spend so much time in flexion that I feel like, you know, even the rowing strength and conditioning is bench pulls, deadlifts, you know, everything in flexion. And I'm like, well, what about the posterior? Like that, we never addressed that. Mm-hmm. And once I did, everything got stronger. Mm-hmm. It was crazy idea, right?
So you had some kind of glaring holes in your total body strength and you didn't even know until.
I had no ass.
Oh, that's unacceptable, that's a terrible disease to have.
Yeah. Most rowers have it. Yeah. Most runners.
So at what point did you guys meet? Was it pre or post no ass?
Oh, it was pre.
Oh, yeah, I met her.
We originally met in 2009.
Is that why it took you 2 or 3 years to start dating me?
Yes.
Oh, gotcha.
No, I met her. There was like a tipping point. Like, oh, the ass is big enough. All right.
Yeah.
No, we originally met in 2009, and she was actually coming off of a broken rib at the time. And this was just post 2008 Olympics. She'd already been CrossFitting a little bit, but then she came to a seminar that I was doing actually down in Chula Vista, right next to the Olympic Training Center. And she came, spent some time with me, and, you know, just started to become more open to ideas. And we stayed in contact through that time. And then, New Year's Day, 2012 was when we started really dating. And that was, and then leading into the 2012 Olympics, we messed around with a lot of stuff, nutrition, training, monitoring, everything. I think the biggest change we made was nutrition. But we also started attacking all these things and figuring out what she could do with 200K a week of other stuff.
And you said that she's pretty low carb, even with that high volume.
At that point, yeah, we actually dropped carbs, at that point. And increased fat. You know, one of the typical things, you know, I just saw that Rob actually had done a recent post on adding carbs for Rob Wolf on adding carbs, and he's seen women that like tend to lose cycles and stuff with things like that. so it was interesting because I've seen it that way, but I've also seen it where there's just no fat in the diet. And that was where a lot of these gals have been at, especially at the elite level. I even see it with men where they're just terrified of fat intake. And so the big thing is that we actually upped her fat intake, which in lowering the carbs allowed for a lot. And we immediately within the first week, we saw recovery levels just increase. I mean, she was recovering faster. She was feeling better. Everything was just starting to make a whole lot more sense.
Right. So how he said you were feeling better, but how, like from your perspective or your own thoughts, like how were you feeling? Like what was that transition like?
From what I remember, it definitely wasn't immediate. You know, you kind of your body has to adjust to this new fuel source. I lived the endurance carb life. You know, you go out to Italian food and eat a big plate of pasta or whatever, you get carb load before your races, you know? Yeah.
She's Italian.
So when I was introduced to CrossFit, I started trying out this paleo thing, but still, you know, I was scared of fat. I'll say it now. Yeah. I thought fat made you fat, you know, and that's
why it's called fat.
That's what, you know, it just made sense. 1-to-1.
Sounds intuitive. Yeah.
It was a good marketing scheme, right? So I definitely took a little bit of time and trust to, you know, he would give me a spoonful of coconut oil and be like, here you go. I'm like, okay, here it goes down the hatch. But, you know, there's that transition. Some people call it, you know, the ketogenic flu. I think I had a little bit of that. I don't know if it was the volume or what, but, you know, your mood kind of gets a little messed up. You feel like you got the flu or you're a little sick. You just don't feel right.
I've seen that with people who go from high carb to like paleo, and then like a few days in, they're just like, I'm like, oh, you're just burning a ton of fat.
And all you want is like to crush some like chips or, you know, it's all you want to do. But then, you know, once you break past that, you're good to go. And it literally, you know, they say when you get older, you're supposed to have less energy and recover, you know, recovery time is supposed to be a lot slower. But my early days of rowing was all plagued with injury. Like I either had a broken rib, a torn QL, like this or that, you know, throughout my early career. And then towards the end of my career, well, especially my last year is when I didn't have an injury.
Yeah, you're just not getting enough fat to produce the hormones necessary to recover.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's what people miss out on. They think about fat making you fat, but don't think that you need fat to create all these hormones that are necessary for recovery.
Yeah,
right.
Too.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because the norm is these, none of these gals get their cycle. Like they're not, and they're like, oh yeah.
It's kind of like a badge of honor. Yeah, you're like, oh, I'm training hard.
I'm training hard right now. And right. It's like, no, that's not.
You're not
okay.
Recovering.
You're
not
optimal. Yeah. You're actually not optimal. You're actually dealing with a lot more inflammation at this point. And, you know, it's bam. And like immediately things change for her. So that was a big, big plus for her.
So we shooting for 2016, 2 years out.
Ooh. yeah, no, you know, I am very satisfied with my rowing career and what I've done so far. Like I'm a happy person with the accolades that I've collected. There is still a question in my mind. You know, I still got both of the gold medals through a long, slow distance program. And so there still is this question in my mind that can you have less injury? And, you know, especially for the older rowers or the rowers that are going through a second cycle, or even not just rowers, but endurance athletes, can you still be successful? Can you go fast under an interval based program?
Yeah. And Brian, I remember, I've been following you for years and I remember reading, like how you would crush pizza on an ultra marathon.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You were like, fuck it, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just going to like, you know, at whatever mile marker, I have a pizza waiting on me and I just crushed that. And I was like, interesting. And then like kind of changed your tune a few years ago.
Yeah. The moment I actually started eating paleo was like that all changed, which that was in my last 100 miler, which was in 2007. Mm-hmm. So I was eating clean at that point. I was not, I'd eaten cheeseburgers during that, but I still eat cheeseburgers today, just not with a bun typically, but during runs and stuff I would absolutely eat pizza. I would, you know, and so would guys like Dean Karnazes, who a lot of people know about. You know, he used to eat crush all that stuff. He doesn't do any of that anymore. I think we've all kind of wised up a little bit to the point of, you know, I mean, if we actually want to last longer, if we actually want to recover quicker, because we are not getting younger, that we're going to need to smarten up a little bit about this stuff. And it wasn't that I was being dumb. It was just like, oh, I need to fuel myself. I need to do this.
Right.
But then it's like, you start to realize, what am I fueling myself with? And now we're seeing guys, literally, there was a guy who won a 100 miler not too long ago, who he's on a, I believe he's on a low carb diet. I know it's grain free. Mm-hmm. It's basically paleo.
Yeah.
He took in 1500 calories total on a 100 mile run.
Wow.
And you can do that if you're at a point to where you've got your body trained enough to deal with something like that. And
you think that's an individual thing, though? You think some people just, no matter what, they're just not going to do well on that low carb for that distance?
I don't, in the ultra marathon world, no. I think a lot of people could actually. I think the intensity is low enough.
Gotcha.
You get CrossFitters and people who are doing a ton of intensity. Like you get a CrossFit endurance athlete. Mm-hmm. So that's a ton of intensity. You're going to need actually to replace some of those carbohydrates at a higher scale.
Right.
You know, and that's where it'll catch you. And I've been in that boat. You know, I wanted to believe that low carb, no carb would work forever. And but that was not what happened. And you hit walls and you go, okay, I guess I got to add this back in.
It doesn't work if you're doing CrossFit competitive style. Like you're burning a ton of sugar.
Yeah, but
when you're doing those,
in essence, like
workouts.
A CrossFit endurance program is literally going to be, you know, there's going to be 2-3 days a week where you're doing doubles, if not triples, depending upon how long you're into this and how competitive you want to be with your racing. So, you know, and that was that was probably one of the first programs that was out there with CrossFit where it was actually putting out 2-a-day workouts, 3-a-day, you know, things like that. So when you're doing, if you're doing CrossFit in the morning and then in the evening, you're doing 400 meter repeats till your butt falls off. That's a whole lot of, that's a whole lot of tapping that glycolytic system.
Yeah. In which case, I mean, what do you do for carbs at that point?
Well, I mean, you've got sweet potatoes, you got things like that. Can you handle milk? Can you handle stuff like that? I mean, like with you, it's like, you know, you got the goat milk thing. I mean, there's a positive right there, right? You know, but it's all based on what you can handle, what your body is not allergic to, what you don't have poor reactions to. And I honestly believe that unless you're willing to pull everything out that you potentially could be allergic to, there's no way to really find out unless you're going to get extensive, expensive blood work done right now.
Yeah.
Which, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, that's not going to be extensive, expensive. It's going to be a prick of the finger. Boom. Here's what you're allergic to here, you know?
And yeah.
You know, so
right now people, what a good idea would be like remove anything that could make you allergic. Or that you could be allergic to, add things in. You know,
yeah.
Go clean for like 30 days, add things in every third day,
you
add in
it.
Something new.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you'll find out, like, you know, sometimes like my wife, she did that and then she added in like maybe 10 things. It's like 2 months into this thing.
Yeah.
And then she adds tomatoes back in and tomatoes destroy her. And it's like, oh, all
wow.
Right. So now she knows, like, something that everyone's like, well, tomatoes are good for you. Type of thing. Right.
They're good paleo. For your colon.
Yeah. But like, you know, tomatoes just upset her stomach. And so she just can't, especially if she's going to train that day.
So yeah. I think a lot of people have heard to do that, to go cold turkey, basically just meat and veggies, and then add stuff in slowly. Typically, what do you start with when you add stuff back in? Like what's the most common, like first five foods that you would
dairy.
Add back in? Dairy is the first thing you add back in?
I'd toss around dairy. Mm-hmm. Just because most people love dairy. You know, it's like, okay, mm-hmm. well, let's find out if you've got that allergy, if there's a reaction, and you'll know immediately mm-hmm. with the dairy thing, you know, you'll then maybe typically bread or grains, things that, you know, you really crave and like. Mm-hmm. This also becomes a very slippery slope for a lot of people mm-hmm. where they go from being paleo or low carb right back into high carb because they're like, oh yeah, I want my dairy. I want my bread, I want this, I want that. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, you're on a high carb diet again mm-hmm. where, you know, for most people, that's just not as optimal. Just because it's functioned well for what it's been mm-hmm. doesn't mean that that's necessarily in my experience, mm-hmm. it's because I've been high carb and I've had every one of my athletes high carb in the past. Mm-hmm. The comparison between being high carb to paleo and actually monitoring and watching this type of stuff mm-hmm. is night and day. The recoverability, all that stuff.
How would you describe high carb, like percentage of calories, and what would you define as like low carb?
I think over 60%, you know,
would be high carb.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what would low carb look like on average? I guess you would say
on average, I'd say probably under 40.
So kind of like more of a zone.
Yeah.
Type prescription.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And you'll see typically even with like zone people in CrossFit is it's like you're on zone for so long and it's like you're like 2 times, 3 times, 4 times fat, 5 times fat. I mean, I walked into CrossFit and Glassman looked at me and was like, what are you on, like a 18 block, 5 times fat? I'm like, how'd you know that? He's like, kid, you're doing ultra marathons. Like you've got to be getting those calories from something, you know? Well,
it's funny though. I remember reading like CrossFit Journal and people remember, you know, I played around with zone for about 3 months. And then I started tweaking from there.
Yeah.
But then people would go, oh, what do you do? And I go, well, you know, I do like 3 times fat, you know, this many blocks, 3 times fat. But then I started thinking, well, you're not doing zone anymore. So like I saw people writing in the CrossFit Journal.
That's my.
they're like, I do zone plus this. I'm like, why are you telling people you do zone? Because you're not.
That
you're doing zone and then you're bastardizing.
We're on the same page with that.
I lasted a week.
Oh,
I
was like,
I am not measuring anything anymore.
Obviously, with the numbers and everything,
well,
I was like, out the door.
I've been measuring things since I was 15 because I was a weird kid. And
really?
I know everything by like grams and calories. So grams and calories, and then you want to like make it in blocks now, and that just confused me. I think it probably helps people that have never counted calories before
mm-hmm.
and grams, but for somebody who's got experience with it, I kind of got lost. I'm like,
yeah.
It's just one more layer of complexity.
Yeah, well,
it'd be like taking grams and now we're doing blocks, which are a bunch of grams. And then if we did cubes, which are a bunch of blocks, and you take one cube of this and one cube of this, then you got to figure out how many blocks are in it, and you got to figure out how many blocks per gram. It's just one more layer of complexity that's not needed if you're already comfortable with grams.
But I do find that it does help people who've never counted calories before.
I agree. But you get somebody to learn, hey, here's how much you actually have to put into your system in order to function mm-hmm. better, and we adjust until you feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
Then you understand how much you actually need when you're training. And yep. then it's like nothing is ever spot on. Mm-hmm. It takes a gram, or, you know, it takes a calorie or a gram of carbohydrate just to digest a gram of, you know, to digest a calorie of carbohydrate. Right. So like if you're counting calories, did you adjust for that? Or, you know, it doesn't all add up. But the fact is you start to see the deal to where you can actually get your hormones regulated, your body in a place to where you can actually synthesize everything to maximize potential and recoverability. And I think that's the important part. And then once you've done something like that, like if I can get somebody to weigh and measure for 3 weeks, good, done. Never do it again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't have to do it. You don't have to do what Bledsoe did. You
don't. Just once they have the perspective of what their plate is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
Then they
exactly.
got it.
And I mean, you take somebody like Rich, who's just like, I don't do anything. I just get it away. You know, I barely eat. And I, you know, yeah, he does not eat that much.
The funny thing, I remember, this was like maybe a year and a half ago. So I was talking about Mike McGoldrick last night. We were standing around and, yeah. Mike McGoldrick is a games athlete, and I'm good friends with him, and he is more dialed in than any athlete. Like he's able to count everything. He's very disciplined. And then he came and hang out with Rich for a weekend and train. And like, I'm getting like text messages, like this dude is eating Pop Tarts and s'mores and he's eating cereal for dinner. And like, he's totally blown away. And he recognizes that would not work for him, but it works for Rich.
I think Rich is at a point where Rich's body has adapted to just whatever he wants to do.
Whatever he wants it to do.
But and you as a human being, that if you think you can step into something like that, like you're just not going to do it. Like I'm positive she would melt if she were to start crushing cereal and eating Pop-Tarts and doing things like that. I mean, we've seen it with just dairy type of stuff, you know,
yeah,
with her.
My whole life would fall apart.
Yeah.
Just everything. The marriage, the house, yeah. Everything.
That's the point. Like, I think a lot of, you know, people try to look and see what the top athletes are doing and they think that is the ideal.
Right.
It's not the ideal. Like, even with position and how you move, like, you know, Jason Kalipa, like, yeah, he can pull a great score on 2K and you know, half marathon, but is that the ideal way to row? No, not necessarily.
He could probably do it better if he just cleaned up his form. Is that what you're saying?
Aaron's
calling you out, Jason.
I know. I'm just saying, look at the people at the top of their sport. Right. You know, like or not just the top of their sport, but look at the best position you should be in, or look at the best, you know, research out there on diet. What is the ideal?
Yeah.
Have that be your ideal, not what, you know, Rich is eating or
yeah, I think
how Jason's rowing.
A lot of these guys are doing things that appear to us to be not ideal, but because they're doing well, why change?
Yeah.
Like if I'm being extremely successful, why would I change? Could they do better? Maybe.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, why change if you're doing the best? But yeah, what you're saying is don't use those guys as an example.
Like, yeah.
There will be a time and a place that everybody will change.
Yeah.
And it always happens. And when you're 26, 27,
right.
You
might handle inflammation a little bit differently at 26 than you do at 36.
And it's a totally different game. It's a totally different ball game. And nobody really takes that into context. They're always, oh, well, if he's eating peanut butter and jelly, guess what? That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, you don't understand.
Yeah, I think
don't get it.
I've talked to this about, I think we may have mentioned, talked about it a little bit last night, and I've had many conversations about this, is that people look at what Rich is doing right now and want to mimic what he does right now, but never take into account everything he did leading up till now. Maybe you should start where he started and then build your way up.
Yeah, like the first year he went to the games, how many workouts a day was he doing? Two, three, maybe? Tops.
Yeah, and he was getting them. I talked to him about that. I was like, how do you train? I saw him at sectionals, and then I saw him again at regionals. And he was like, oh, you know, I just go to a website, and I just pick one, and then I go to another website. He was just going to different gyms' websites and cherry-picking workouts. But he was doing like two or three a day. And at that time, that like just blew my mind. I was like, all right.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody wants the secret, you know, like everybody talks about this and there is no secret, mm-hmm. you know, and the fact that he's just training or just eating what he wants, that's actually not the answer either. it's you got to look at the entire path, and it's like you look at her entire path of her career, and it was in the beginning, it caught up with her pretty quickly in at the 2008 Olympics, you know, where it was like they won a gold, but what did that feel like? Where was she at? And it was, you know, broken ribs, torn, you know, QLs. It was thing, you know, and this is something they all deal with. And then it's like, how do I fix that? How do I not, how does it not feel like that to where in 2012 she's in tears because she felt like she could have gone harder and raced another race. Yeah. And I'm like, no, that's exactly what it's supposed to feel like. Like that is how you should cross a finish line in the Olympics if you're winning. Like Usain Bolt is smiling at 70 meters and looking at cameras because it's over, because it's done, you know. Right. And that was what it, that's what happened with women's eight. I mean, it was over from 500 meters on.
Yeah.
Done. Yeah, I was freaking out, you know, but she, they, the tape tells a different story, you know. It's just like they were out in front the whole time by a big margin.
I think another thing too, people who come from like that volume background that come into CrossFit, they can usually handle a lot of things thrown at them, and it's almost like you have to lower the volume for them. But if they come from a strength background, they can't jump into the volume, so you got to build them up over time.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. You'll see different variables accelerate. Like a strength background accelerates obviously with anything that's got weight, and you can handle lots of weight, things like that. Whereas an endurance athlete's just going to be able to go and go and go and go and go and tack it on, tack. I mean, that was my experience. Mm-hmm. I came into, you know, into CrossFit with this enormous aerobic base, but I still had no idea what intensity was. And, you know, doing a 6-minute Fran for your first time, I was, you know, on my ass. There wasn't enough oxygen in the room. And, you know, there I thought I had this enormous, you know,
right
capacity. And it was like, what just happened? And that makes the wheels spin, man. That's like, whoa, what is that?
All right, we're going to take a break real quick. When we come back, we're going to find out exactly what you guys are doing in Cookeville. The secret. Oh. Yeah, we're going to release the secret. And we're back. Boom. Hanging out in Cookeville. We got Brian McKenzie. Aaron Cafaro.
Oh.
Boom.
Round two. Got it. So what's the big secret?
Big secret.
Putting them on the spot with that one.
Which big secret?
Yeah, you know, the real reason you guys are here.
Training camp. Oh, training camp.
Yeah.
Kind of timed it to where Aaron was doing a seminar last weekend. Wanted to come out and hang out with Thomas, his wife. And
Thomas is super cool.
Yeah.
I've met him several times, but we got to spend more time with him in the last day, like,
yeah,
than I have before.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's super cool.
Thomas is a man. And then working with Thomas, working with Rich all this week, and then leading into 14.1, and we're doing a training camp this weekend at CrossFit Mayhem with Athlete Cell.
So they're going to announce the WOD tomorrow night.
Yep.
And then everyone at Mayhem is going to crush it on Friday night.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then have a big party.
They'll have a big party. Yeah. That's right.
And then do another three or four workouts on Saturday and Sunday.
So 14.1 Friday night, and then four workouts on Saturday.
Five workouts on Saturday, and then I believe four workouts on Sunday.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. At training camp, we got to get these kids dosed. You know? Dosed. Walk away with something and then recover during the week. And then you got to do 14.2 on.
We'll just take Monday through Thursday off.
Right?
Yeah.
So now,
Aaron, do you participate in any of that? You can do the open and whatnot?
Yeah, I signed up for it last year. I haven't signed up yet, but I feel
like Monday sign up.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Just show my support, you know. But I'm not competitive.
Just doing it for fun.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big girl in the CrossFit world, so
bullshit.
You know.
She's the most competitive person in the room at all times.
No.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
We should get like a game of chicken foot or something going on tonight. It'd be crazy.
So we were in here the other day, and we were all talking to Thomas Cox, and
yes,
he was saying that when coaching football players, there's kind of three types of guys that he trains. There's the guys that they train super hard all week long, and then on Saturday, they do exactly what they did in practice. Exact same intensity, exact same, like if they run a route, they run it the exact same way in the game. Whatever they do in practice is exactly how the game's going to go, and they know that that person is super consistent every single time. Then there's other guys who they train super hard all week, get in the game, and just screw up the whole thing. They can't compete under pressure. They always find a way to mess it up. Mm-hmm. And then there's guys that are the total opposite. They kind of just like coast through practice, and they work pretty hard, but not like amazingly hard. And then something about game day, they just turn it on, and they're incredible.
Yeah.
Are you one of those three avatars?
He's asking if you're blue.
Blue?
Never mind.
Yeah.
It's a movie reference.
The blue avatars from the movie.
I do have a braid, though.
Right? I get distracted anytime anyone uses the word avatar.
Their braid? Yeah.
I don't know what camp I fall in. I definitely...
Brian's like, you don't know?
Brian knows exactly which camp you fall in.
He's like, you are not self-aware.
I know which one I don't fall in.
Humility actually is one of her downfalls.
Oh, really?
She's so humble with everything that she tends to overdo it.
No.
She's number one. She works her tail off and then puts everything together when it's time to put it together.
So you're super consistent?
Yes.
Yeah, but on game day, like there's something there that you just can't replicate in training. Mm-hmm. But
you perform well.
Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to competing or testing because that's just where I am at that point. Like, I don't feel any extra pressure because I'm like,
you're not a basket case on competition day.
No.
Even for the Olympics?
I get excited. Everybody's like, oh, how do you deal with butterflies? I'm like, if they aren't there, that's when I get nervous because then the first part of that race is going to hurt really bad, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a trip for me to see her at the Olympics. I was there for 10 days and I saw her a couple times. But when they raced, like she saw me, she saw her family. It was just stone cold, nothing. It's such a game.
It's not heartless.
No.
Did she scare you?
No, it didn't scare me. No. It didn't scare. It's intriguing to me because as a coach, you look at all these athletes, you see these athletes, but it's like, you know, I relate it to somebody who's like kind of like spec ops or something military when it's like it's time to go in and do something. Like you see all this stuff and you meet these guys and you work with them and there's a switch. They're just certain individuals that have it and it's boom, I'm on.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not. I credit our coach for that a lot too because, you know, in the boat, he can't go out there with us. He can't be on the sidelines yelling at us. He knew that. He just tried to give us as much confidence in ourselves and say, you're ready. I mean, the pre-race talk, sometimes they were like profound, but usually it's just like, you're ready. You know, he's not going to hold your hand. He's not going to, you know, tell you secret move to do. It's just like, go do what you do every day. You know, you're prepared, you're ready. And that, I think that's the best thing that, you know, one of the best things about my coach for the Olympic team was that he had a really good job of getting us ready and confident in ourselves. Whereas sometimes I see with these other athletes, they still need to have their hand held and they almost don't take responsibility for all the work that they put in. They attribute it to their coach more than anything. And they're like, oh, you know, I don't know how to approach this workout without my coach telling me. Well, yeah, you do. Like, get out there, go. You know, it also helps to be in a boat with a lot of other women who are
alpha females
who are exactly like me. It was just the environment that I was in. And I guess that's part of the humility thing is that, you know, I was not any better than the rest of my teammates and I wouldn't get anywhere without the rest of my teammates. You know, rowing is the ultimate team sport. But you do, I mean, it's not like we were all passive and, you know, like, oh no, you go first. No, it was a cat fight. Like it was literally like a shark tank, like training. We would be tearing each other apart and it was the
oddest thing
we were
I've witnessed in sport.
Oh,
literally,
yeah.
Cause here's a team of women. There's like, I think, how many of you guys start off with 30 roughly in the program? Something like that.
Yeah, and the, you know, the
and
first
it just
year
chips
the
away. It just chips.
Like
they,
60,
and they just start
and then it's 30
out,
and
out,
then it's
out,
20.
Out,
yeah.
Out,
it's
out.
Like a celebration when someone leaves. Like during the attrition.
No, but everyone.
Because I've seen programs where like when someone leaves, it's almost like some people are like celebrating because that means.
Well,
they just
there are certain individuals that I think that everybody's like always like, yes, Thank God. Right. Yeah. That was a detriment. That was somebody who was not helping the team. But yeah. You've got a bunch of women who, most of these girls are literally Ivy Leaguers, mm-hmm. who went from a Ivy League school out to a national team, who are not making any money, mm-hmm. even though they're in a professional sport, mm-hmm. who are willing to sacrifice everything and anything to win a race. And they're all, nobody wants to share any on the team. Nobody on the team wants to share anything that they're doing extra or
really?
Oh yeah. And then the coach, you know, I have to give it to her coach, because he did create an environment mm-hmm. like nothing I've ever seen, where there's just a command of respect, but a respect that did not build that did not enable athletes. It empowered athletes, and it told these girls to step up when it was time to step up. I'm not going to hold your hand ever. You're going to go out and you're going to do what you're supposed to do, what your damn job is. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And you just don't see a lot of that, you know? And I mean, that's kind of the school I really was brought up in. And it was just like, there's no hand holding. There's no, you have a job to go do it. Mm-hmm. You know,
everyone's responsible for themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what but when it came together, I mean, when these girls had to go compete, boom, they were a team. All of a sudden, you have like this shark tank of women who are some of the most educated on the planet, who are like, who could be lawyers and, you know, doctors and like just these alpha females somewhere in the professional world that have chosen not to do that and take no money vying for an Olympic medal. And it's pretty interesting.
We were just stoked that we didn't have to compete against each other again. We were the rest of the world. Okay, phew. At least I don't have to compete against, you know, Caroline.
Wow.
Yeah. You see that, you know, my understanding with a lot of the, you know, cross athletes that I've seen is just like, you see a lot of these kids who are not the ones that need to be handheld, and they are winning.
Mm-hmm. You're saying the other day that rowers and other Olympic athletes, especially the ones that aren't making any money, which is probably most Olympic athletes, mm-hmm. like they are willing to sacrifice everything, as you just said. And
yes.
Yesterday you were mentioning something about like they would just call random families and just be like, hey, can I stay with you?
Yeah.
Which is like, that's a hard families. Thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like
host families.
Yeah. Like maybe elaborate on that.
No, I mean, there's potential for things to happen with us, but there's, you know, like these girls will literally go from college to or whatever each year, and they contact a family in the area where they're going to literally have to train and say, hey, I can't afford to really live. I'm wondering if you might be able to let me have a room in your house and I'll live with you while I train for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And it's a yes or no. And there are in Princeton, there are these families that have literally opened up their homes to these athletes and are taking care of these athletes. Mm-hmm. And allowed them to do that. And they have literally packed up everything from where they're from, whether it's, you know, you're from Yale or whether you're from Stanford or whether you're from Cal, packed up, moved to Princeton, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where they're going.
And that's something that you were saying a lot of CrossFit athletes are starting to realize now, is that they have to start training like that. They need to not have a job. They have to train multiple times a day. Like if you want to get to the upper level, if you want to go to the games and be successful at the games, and especially if you want a podium, you can't have a job and be taking care of your two kids
and
be having like a different business you're trying to grow on the side and trying to train multiple times a day.
What I think we'll see. Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. I think right now it's the person who wins it that's doing that. And there's a few that aren't doing it below that. But, and then there's guys that own gyms, but are they really working at gyms? Like Mike was saying last night, but anybody who's working a job and literally trying to train to win the CrossFit Games, they don't understand what energy means. They don't understand that. They don't understand recovery. Mm-hmm. And literally, you know, you got somebody who's doing 200 kilometers a week, who's doing some extra work on the side, you know, to make sure that we fix those imbalances, who's eating she's waking up, eating, going to practice, coming home, eating, sleeping, going to practice, coming home, eating, sleeping, training again.
Yeah.
So you're taking multiple naps a day when you were getting ready for the Olympics?
There was one or two. Mm-hmm. At least one.
Every day.
No,
minimum.
I would
say I do that so I can work.
From like 10 to 14 hours. There's some days
we
like
monitored.
If we had a long, long week, long, hard week, I would sleep 14 hours, you know, like 10 at night and then a 4-hour nap. And that was my recovery. Mm-hmm. Most people
probably never worked hard enough where they could accomplish that. They wouldn't be able to sleep all that time.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to stay asleep. They would just lie there.
She is a professional, sleeper. I'm not kidding, dude. It's like a bear hibernating the moment she goes to sleep. But she's also one of those people who goes into deep sleep immediately. Like it's an immediately start. She's jumping, twitching. You know the deep sleep is happening where it's like, you know, somebody like me is not, who's constantly thinking and trying to fix things and wants to do things, is like, I'm not a deep sleeper until it's late. You know, she's deep sleep immediately.
Probably a sign of success or potential success.
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, 14 hours a day. I mean, and a lot of people complain, and I tell them, get 9. They're like, I've got to get 9.
Yeah.
Like I'm crazy. I'm like, yeah, but you look at like the top athletes, all they do is train, take naps, eat. I think my friend Max, he described like what a professional athlete looks like. He's like, it's training, sleeping, and playing video games. Like you should not be having to worry about anything.
Other than the video games, I think it was movies and books.
Yeah, but it's not about like avoiding stress. Like,
yes.
If you're working,
exactly.
Even if you're spending that same time where that guy's playing video games, reading books, whatever, and you're spending that same amount of time, but you're working, there's that stress is stress. And a lot of people don't see it that way. And they think, well, I can work a 9 to 5. I can train, you know, 2 or 3 times a day somehow, you know, maybe in the morning, lunch, and the evening. But you're still not going to get, you're not getting enough recovery to get the correct adaptation that you're looking for.
It's stress and willpower. I'm totally of the belief that you can grow your willpower, but I think it is finite. Mm-hmm. And so if you are, you know, you have to make a lot of decisions based on a bunch of other things, you know, if you're working, you have to make decisions at the office, and then you have to make decisions on, you know, how to train. It's finite. You're going to tap yourself out. And my only decision, my decision was, how am I going to get better today? Mm-hmm. You know, like,
yeah,
that was my focus. But you know, I guess I grew up, I'm not that good of a multitasker. I'm trying to get into that, grow myself a little bit more now that, you know, I'm not training full time. But I really like focusing on one thing, because that, you know, it preserves your willpower and your stress levels. And it, you know, obviously, I don't know, for me, it worked.
Willpower is an interesting thing that a lot of people don't know very much about. It's tough to do research on such an intangible thing like willpower. Like, what does that mean? How would you measure it? And how would you test that? But the little that I know about it, I've seen studies where they take people and they'll do something along the lines of, hey, cookies aren't good for you. They'll give like a little talk to people. And then they'll make one group make like 2 decisions, even if they're not hard decisions. Mm-hmm. They'll make another group make like 10 decisions in the same period of time. And then they'll offer those people cookies. And they can find a statistical significant difference between the group that had to make 10 decisions. They're much more likely to go and give in and eat the cookie compared to the other group. And that's been consistently tested and found to be what happens with people when they have to make too many decisions throughout the day. That's why people tell you to do the most important part of your day, or the most important thing of your day first, before you get distracted, before you get worn down, before you get tired, before you lose your willpower. Because if you wait, you know, like if you wait until after work to work out or whatever, you're much less likely to do it.
You don't want to go to your doctor late in the afternoon, because that's when you're going to get a bad prescription. Yeah. Go early in the day.
Yeah.
When he's fresh.
Yeah.
Well, that's another thing too.
Yeah.
They've done that with judges in court.
Yeah.
Like wow. They're just fed up by the end of the day.
Yeah.
You're cooked.
They talk about it in Powerful Engagement with Tony Schwartz and Jim Lehrer.
Yeah.
I don't remember the other book they talked about it in, but yeah, like if you can go, if you like, even if you get like a speeding ticket or whatever, you want to like get it taken off your record. If you go in the morning when everybody's rested, you're like 4 times less likely to get them get the outcome that you're looking for to get it taken off your record than like if you go like right before lunch, where everybody's like hungry and tired.
Mm-hmm.
If you come after lunch, it swings back the other way, where everyone's kind of like they just had a break, they got some food, they have relaxed for a little bit, and they're much more lenient again.
I think they did that. Yeah. I think they did a study with like criminal, like judges that were like looking at like murderers and stuff like that. And like, it's like, if it's late in the afternoon, people were getting the axe. And like, if it's people
it's
early
only
in the day,
life.
Yeah,
it's just your life.
But it's, you know, they looked at all these cases and found that that was kind of what was going on. Wow. It was like, It's like, holy shit. Like, if for some reason, I end up in a predicament. I'm going to try and make every court thing happen in the morning. Like, you never know what could happen, you know?
Or just bring the judge a snack.
Yep, yeah, bring him. Right. There you go.
I always have to have snacks.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's the other thing.
Snacky cakes.
She has a fear of hunger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I call it
when my wife and I first were married, she would actually carry bars around in her purse. Not for her, but for me. Because I would get so agitated when I got hungry. She's like, he gets angry when he gets hungry.
And typically,
like,
that's like what happens. That's what she found out about me. That's what Aaron figured out with me. It was like, yeah. Dude, have you eaten? Because you are nasty.
All right, let's wrap this up. What do you guys want to promote? We got athlete cell camps. We have CrossFit Endurance. Got 3Fuel over here.
Missed 3Fuel right there.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I heard you're the brains behind the operation.
She is.
She runs the whole show.
No, yeah.
See, there's that humility thing.
Yeah. This is like, not me. No. So tell us what it is. 3Fuel.
I guess I was the OG guinea pig for, you know, when I changed my diet in this last Olympic cycle, trying to find a supplement that I could take out in the boat with me. You were out there for 2 hours, or even, you know, something I could take immediately after that when I couldn't have the convenience of real food. Mm-hmm. And so Brian and, you know, he had a business partner, and they went into the lab and, you know, started testing some stuff out, some HDP waxing maize for the carbs, and you know, came up with a 3 macronutrient supplement, you know, the highest quality whey protein you can find on the market. Mm-hmm. And was it the HDP waxy maize? It's called Thermacarb. Mm-hmm. And then a fat, of course,
coconut milk.
Mm-hmm. So those 3 macronutrients in one supplement, and I would take it out in the boat and I wouldn't bonk. I would stay steady. Mm-hmm. And it was a lifesaver, because then, you know, you see everybody else, literally they would have lunches in the bottom of the boat, you know, bars,
goo,
bananas,
cliff shots,
all these little sugar things. And you would see them, like, we would have multiple pieces. You would see them go up and go down and up and down. And it was, you know, I think that helped my recovery a lot too. So that was 3Fuel. And, you know, they basically made it for themselves and their athletes. And I was like, hey, I think other people would like to have some of this too. So I've, you know,
it started off as a very selfish venture and then quickly turned into, you know, maybe we should make this a business.
Yeah. Make something for yourself. And everyone starts asking about where can I get that? And then you go, oh, maybe I should sell this.
Well, like at every seminar we did, you know, with CrossFit Endurance, is the seminars we run with CrossFit is, you know, people, well, what do you fuel yourself with if we're going to eat clean?
Yeah.
And it's like, well,
because liquid calories do come in pretty handy when you're an athlete and you're training a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an inconvenience to stuff, you know, a chicken breast and broccoli and some other, an avocado down your throat.
Yeah. I don't have the appetite sometimes for that.
Yeah.
Getting it down stuff.
Yeah. Especially right in the middle of my workout.
Yeah.
I usually just don't have it available.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how 3Fuel came about. And yeah, it's been taken off. We're coming out with the chocolate. That's been like the biggest thing. I guess everybody likes their, you know, recovery shakes and chocolate. So that's coming. But
how else am I going to get a fix, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else are we doing?
Athlete Cell, which we already talked about.
Yeah. You got your book out there still?
I got my book out there, Power Speed Endurance. We got another book coming out probably between late spring and early summer with Unbreakable Runner. So that'll be a kind of a manifestation of everything I've done with Power Speed Endurance. And then kind of looking at it from a perspective of how we came to these conclusions, why we came to these conclusions, where things have gone, and giving programming out for anywhere from a basic person or a novice person to, you know, intermediate to an elite.
Mm-hmm. We didn't actually talk that much about CrossFit Endurance specifically on this show, but we did mention it a ton on the last show. What episode was that?
Wow.
Episode 82. Wow. I know. Look at this.
How many episodes?
He's a savant. He can just.
Wow. I mean, just rolled that off.
Yeah, 82. So that was like 20 weeks ago.
Yeah.
23 weeks ago. Our first live episode. That was our first live episode. Right. In front of a live audience. Have we done one since?
At the gym.
Like, yeah. Oh, it went so terribly. We offended so many people live.
Did we?
So many F-bombs.
We can't do it again.
Yeah. Can't play that in front of your kids on the way home from work, right?
No. Chris Moore had a few drinks.
Yes, he did.
It only accelerated things for him.
Yeah.
He'll never make it this far on this episode, so he won't even know we talked about him. Yeah. All right, guys. Make sure you get the barbellshrug.com. Sign up for the newsletter so we can inform you of when we... get these podcasts out and a bunch of other cool stuff that we do.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.